they clearly were not culpable in the crimes, but some of them were found to have not done their due diligence in overseeing what happened once this was brought to their attention. Joe Paterno did what he was legally required to do and reported it to his superior. He later, before he died, regretted he had not done more. I regret that he had not done more, too. It's horrible to see one of my heroes of my youth be tarnished in this way. But the point is, were it not for the incredible reporting of a woman named Sarah Ganim, who was with the Harrisburg newspapers, and the courage of a lot of people to come forward, Jerry Sandusky might have gotten away with a lot of things, which are just too heinous to even speak about, and some of them we couldn't even talk about on the air at this time of the day. But I just want to go sort of through the Sandusky timeline. He was brought up the only child of a family in Western Pennsylvania where his father was famous for, and oh, I'm just going to remember that I don't refresh my phone, this won't happen, for being involved in youth sports. He was the only son of Evelyn May, an Irish Catholic homemaker, and Arthur Sandusky, whose parents had immigrated from Poland. And Arthur, the father, served in the field of youth services programs for over 30 years, mostly as director of the Brownson House in Washington, Pennsylvania, a community recreation center for children. There he founded the Pennsylvania Junior Wrestling Program and created junior basketball, volleyball, boxing, and programs, improved the facilities, coached the 1955 Washington baseball team that won the Pony League World Series, the only team from Washington to do that, was inducted into the Pennsylvania Hall of Fame, Sports Hall of Fame, in 1989. Now, I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not going to pretend to be one or play one on television, but when Jerry Sandusky was in high school, he never dated. He was Mr. Clean Cut, whatever. Very smart. When he graduated from Penn State, he graduated with two undergraduate degrees, both first in his class. He was a very good athlete. But the timeline is really interesting because there's some things that happen here that might have set off alarms otherwise. Okay, in 1963, he begins playing 3 years of varsity football for Rip Engel, the coach who preceded Joe Paterno. 1966, he graduates first in his class, is named the top student in his college. 1969, after a short stint at Juniata College in Pennsylvania and at Boston University, where he coached defensive ends, he returned to Penn State as an assistant coach. Now, 1969, just to put this in perspective for listeners who know that I am 67 years old, that's the fall I went to college. So that's how long ago this was. It was a long time ago, in a lot of ways. But then in 1977, he created the Second Mile for at-risk children. Now, that organization was supposedly dedicated to helping at-risk and poor kids succeed in life, get a second chance. And in November of 1990, President Bush gave it his 249th point of light. It was one of the 1,000 points of light. Everybody at this point, up until 1990, and remember now, this is now 21 years since Jerry Sandusky began coaching at Penn State, thinks he's a great guy. In 1998, though, things have changed. Because, though in 1988, Joe Paterno wrote a glowing letter about what a great coach he would be when he was applying for the job at Temple, in 1998, Paterno told him he would not become the next coach at Penn State. Now, one of the things that Ron Smith hasn't talked about but sticks out in my mind is you may remember right before Al Groh got the job at Virginia as the head coach after coming out of the Jets, Sandusky was rumored to be on the list of people. But Sandusky, very shortly after saying he was interested, said, no, I'm really done with football. I really, you know, my days of coaching are over. Well, not really. Because after he's told in 1998 he wouldn't be the head coach in January, in May of 1998, he sexually assaulted a boy on the Penn State campus. This was later proven in court. This is not an alleged. And also on May 4th, a woman named Alicia Chambers, who I mentioned last week and who should be just glorified for being right and should have been trusted, said that Sandusky was a likely pedophile. I hate that word, pedophile. It should be pedoscale, child hater, not child lover. And Gary Schultz, a Penn State official, began on May 4th, a confidential file on Sandusky. Graham Spanier, Gary Schultz, Tim Curley, and Joe Paterno are informed the next day that there is an investigation of Sandusky. However, the district attorney declined to prosecute, and the Penn State police closed the case. And a lot of people have thrown aspersions at Penn State and Paterno and the rest. The grand district attorney did not feel that he had enough evidence to proceed, and no one has ever indicated or suggested that anybody interfered with that investigation. So immediately after that, in June of 1999, Jerry Sandusky is told that he's going to retire after one more year as coaching. And he wrote his book, Touch, the Jerry Sandusky Story. But however, shortly after that, in February of 2001, Mike McQuarrie sees the now retired Professor Emeritus Jerry Sandusky violating a boy on a building and campus in a shower, reports it to Paterno. Paterno reports it to Tim Curley, his immediate boss, and they decide not reporting it to legal officials. Not Joe Paterno, but Schultz, Curley, and Spanier. But they do go to the second mile, and they tell them, well, your guy who's running your place has been accused of this. He leaves the building. Now, Sandusky was given, and this is a very odd thing, he was given emeritus status as a professor. You know, emeritus status usually only goes to the most worthy academic honorees. I mean, not everybody who retires even after 30 years becomes professor emeritus. Professor emeritus meant that he could continue to use facilities at Penn State. But in fall of 2003, Mr. Sandusky is clearly not through with football, and he becomes a volunteer assistant coach at Central Mountain High School. This proves his undoing because while there, a Central Mountain wrestling coach observes him actively molesting a child. That starts the investigation. And once that investigation starts, it really starts to snowball because parents start asking questions. People start going to legal authorities. And the NCAA decides that they're going to make Penn State pay for this. Now, the point is, no one at Penn State except Jerry Sandusky was accused of any criminal wrongdoing at this time. And the NCAA decided, I think because they'd never been able to nail Penn State for anything, they'd never had any major violations, and certainly in the football program, they had had to fire Renee Portland, a basketball coach, because she had discriminated against lesbian players. But there were no big outstanding charges against Penn State, and they wanted to go after Paterno because he had gotten for them too big. But Joe Paterno was bigger than Mark Emmert. I mean, that's my interpretation. Eventually, Sandusky goes is indicted. He goes to trial. It takes 2 years. He's found guilty on 45 of 48 charges from child rape to child endangerment, and he is sentenced to 30 to 60 years. If he lives to 2042, he's 74, and he won't. He would then be eligible to seek parole, though I kind of doubt that parole would be at that time offered. So what we have are the two sort of simultaneous timelines that intersect: the unraveling of Jerry Sandusky's wrongdoing and his sexual assault and molestation, and the NCAA's clearly prejudicial and unprofessional investigation, which resulted in virtually every sanction against Penn State being rescinded. The 111 victories were returned to Paterno, 111 and 112. I don't know why that was the case. And all but the $60 million fine. But in the end, the state of Pennsylvania paid somewhere between $700 million and $1 billion when all this is fleshed out. And Ron can explain that better than me.
So from your perspective, Bruce, yeah, is Paterno a villain in this?
No. Paterno is an old school Italian Catholic guy who, a brilliant man, as we know, graduated from Brown, very, very smart, wrote, you know, academic papers. He reported what he knew. He saw Sandusky out the door. He did not do what he should have done by following through a little more. But a villain, no. A flawed man who made a mistake, yes. But
And not following through, was that done, do you think, from what you've read in the book, was that done to protect the program?
I don't know. And that is the nagging question, Rich. I don't My gut instinct is that it was in part to protect his family, but his family was as much Penn State football as it was his wife and his kids. I think it may have... Mike McCreary talks how Paterno slumped back in his chair in just disbelief and just couldn't believe it had happened. And I think he figured once law enforcement investigated and it wasn't, and they didn't prosecute, that he had done what he should have done. I can't say he did.
You know, and there's also the notion, and this came up, this was discussed, I think, at the time, for that generation of men, and particularly, I think, ironically, Catholic men.
Yeah.
It's such a foreign idea to them that they have a hard time even imagining that it's real.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you think of how many people didn't, how long members of the clergy have been abusing, and primarily it comes out in the Catholic Church, but trust me, it happens in the other ones, members of the clergy abusing people who said, no one will believe me.
Mm.
And I think that with the young kids that Sandusky groomed, and he was incredibly evil at this, grooming young kids, all their life they'd been in trouble. People didn't believe them. How were they going to believe them that this was true? So I think that if Sandusky, you know, he's had 6 adopted children, abused some of them. One of them went on to request nude pictures from a teenage girl and send other stuff. He ended up going to prison for it. You know, the apple doesn't roll far from the tree sometimes. And I think that there's this pattern of sexual abuse is something that unless you really experience it, and I certainly never have, so I don't know, I think you're getting your head around how it happens is difficult. I mean, I think to myself, yeah, you try and do that to me and you're going to lose all your teeth, right? Well, that's one thing to say, but when you're a 10-year-old kid and someone is big and huge and strong, I just think I want people to read Half the House by Richard Hoffman, my dear friend, who blew the whistle on a baseball coach who had abused him and hundreds of other kids and kept records. We're explaining how it happens that you don't say anything. It's one of the most powerful books I've ever read. And I kept thinking about it as I was reading this, that you know, unless you know for sure that it's happening, people don't believe it. And so I'm still bewildered by it, Rich. I don't have a full handle on it. I've now read 2 full books on it. I've been doing some other research, and I'm just hoping Ron can figure it out a little bit more for me.
Yeah.
And he may not know either.
The book is called Nailed to the Crossbar, Ron Smith, and he'll join us next week on Sports Lit 101.